This week on the Back Table Podcast.
The reality is upper GI bleeding falls more into that bread and butter IR category. So you're probably going to be able to get this etiology or path of disease treated with pretty much any microcatheter that you have on your shelf. A lot of it just comes down to operator comfort and what you like to use. I think if you do get some weird bleed, like where it might be coming off some tiny, tiny little branch or something crazy like that, then you may want to start thinking about your true select microcatheters, your prograde alpha, those neuro microcatheters. We were just at Guess MSK where they're using 1.7 French microcatheters, that type of stuff where you might need to start doing fancy catheterizations.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Back Table Podcast, your source for all things interventional and endovascular. You can find all previous episodes of our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and on backtable.com. First, a brief message from our sponsor. Achieving complete and rapid vessel occlusion has never been easy, until now. Introducing Obsidio Conformable Embolic by Boston Scientific. Obsidio Embolic is an FDA-cleared device with shear thinning technology, the first embolic of its kind to have a specific on-label indication for peripheral use in the U.S. Delivered in a ready-to-use 1-milliliter syringe, Obsidio Embolic is a pre-mixed aqueous-based solution that starts as an injectable soft solid, flows through the microcatheter as a liquid when force is applied, and returns to a soft solid to occlude the vessel. Obsidio Embolic is quick to deploy, helps the body promote a natural healing response, and ensures confidence like never before in patient outcomes, in procedure, and for life. The first ever conformable embolic is here, simply different, simply Obsidio. Visit bostonscientific.com/obsidio to learn more. Now, back to the episode.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Back to the Well Podcast. Today, we have a very special episode discussing treatment algorithms and new technologies for upper GI bleed embolization. Everybody's probably remembered the lower GI bleed embolization episodes we've done, both with Sabine Don in the past, as well as with Dr. Kevin Hensler. This one, we're going to be focusing more on upper GI bleeds. Again, our recurring guest, Dr. Oz Ahmed. Oz, welcome back to the show.
What's up, Aaron? How are you?
So Oz, for those who did not, and it was great to hang out with you at Guest MSK, we might as well plug Guest MSK while we're here. And we have the new MSK show. So for the listeners, please go check that out. But great conference. You gave a great talk. We'll have to have you come back on for GAE as well.
Would be my honor. And like you said, it was an incredible meeting, incredible location. I mean, just everything about it was 10 out of 10.
Yeah, it was a good lineup. So hopefully they keep doing it in Paris because it's an excuse to come back.
Totally.
So Oz, you're a world traveler though, you're all over the place. Thank you so much for joining this early in the morning. For those who are unfamiliar with you and where you're at, please just give us a quick intro where you're at, what your practice looks like.
Yeah, thanks so much. I'm an interventional radiologist. I practice in Chicago at the University of Chicago. I'm essentially born and raised in Chicago, so it's a natural fit for me to be here. My practice is a little bit all over the place, which sort of matches my personality in terms of what I like to do. So, but that includes oncology, embolization, venous thromboembolism, and then obviously most recently, musculoskeletal interventions.
Fantastic. And so yeah, today we're going to be talking about upper GI bleeds. We're going to jump right into it. I wanted to start out with how do these patients typically present in your practice, and also talk about the different causes. We have a lot of trainee listeners talk about arterial versus portal hypertension causes.
Yeah, that's a great comment. I mean, I think especially when we talk to trainees, when someone presents with an upper GI bleed, it's really important to delineate the etiology, because if the bleeding is arterial versus venous, venous being variceal hemorrhage, the management and the pathway is very, very different. But I think first line therapy for upper GI bleeding always includes endoscopy, which helps delineate what that etiology of bleeding is. And again, like I said, helps sort of triage which pathway that patient goes. But beyond that, I think we're going to be talking more about arterial bleeding today. But arterial bleeding typically occurs secondary to peptic ulcer disease, whether that's related to NSAID use, H. pylori, things like that. And these patients can present sort of in a variety of ways. Most commonly, they present with hematemesis or coffee ground emesis, but also they can present with hematochezia, bright red blood, if it's a very brisk bleed, and or melena.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. Great summary. Is it typically, like in my practice, it's usually the GI docs either calling up, coming down to the lab saying, hey, we got a bleeder. And they usually know, right? They're like, oh, this is cirrhotic patient. Is this going to be down the TIPS route, or they're going to say, no, I saw an ulcer on exam? Like you said, they usually are giving that information, but is that typically how you're getting them in your practice as well by the GI department?
Yeah, totally. I think especially for upper GI bleed, that pathway is pretty set in stone in that GI is typically consulted for an endoscopy. Now, rarely you will get somebody maybe who has hematochezia or something like that where they think it's a lower GI bleed and contact IR first, maybe even get a CTA. But more often than not, these patients are coming after GI has done some sort of scope and then called you to sort of let you know what they found and were unable to control that bleeding.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, in your practice, are you seeing more upper or lower GI bleeds? I think I know the answer, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, it's actually a pretty good mix. You know, upper GI bleeding tends to be pretty common, but I think it's a little bit of a self-selection because the upper GI bleeds, for the most part, go to GI and they're pretty good at controlling it. So whereas lower GI is not as preferable from an endoscopic approach. So I think our practice comprises more of lower GI bleeds, but I think that the reality is because that's what the bleeding that's not be able to controlled by GI.
Yeah, that's true. There's a lot more real estate in the lower GI bleeds that they got to try and figure out. And it's more mysterious in the lower GI system, right? Which is kind of annoying at times. I mean, that's a great point. Like upper GI bleeds tend to be pretty straightforward versus the lower GI bleeds, right?
Yeah, like I think like you alluded to, if it's an arterial bleed, typically related to some sort of ulcer, that more often than not, they're able to get in there and clip or cauterize.
Yeah. So the other great point that you brought up was pre-procedure imaging. When there's a lower GI bleed consultation, typically, and we've talked about this before on the show, CTA is usually like kind of like the first step, especially since they've come a long ways recently and the imaging is pretty good. You really want to kind of zero in on what vascular bed you're going to target. Whereas with the upper GI bleeds, the GI docs are giving you pretty good information typically as to where that bleed's coming from. Are you doing any kind of pre-procedure imaging on for upper GI bleeds ever?
Typically not. I mean, I think you just gave a really nice summary of the importance of imaging, especially for lower GI bleeding. And I think we're probably both old enough to remember, you know, the days of our residency where everybody got a tagged RBC scan and you wait 3 hours for that to result. And you have to game the system because if you get it on call, you want to try to push the study till the morning or whatnot. But now, obviously, CTA has revolutionized the way we, I think, triage and treat lower GI bleeds. And we can even now potentially even prophylactically treat bleeding vessels that we don't identify on angio because we saw them active on the CTA. But I think, like you said, for upper GI bleed, still tried and true method is relying on your endoscopist to localize the bleed. And I think there's two fundamental reasons for that. One is you can ask your endoscopist, and which we frequently or routinely do, is to localize that bleeding for you. Say, hey, is it coming from the fundus? Is it coming from the duodenum? Wherever it's coming, can you place some clips? Give me some anatomic thing that I can look for on fluoroscopy to help localize the bleeding. So you have that. And then the other reason I think that we typically don't get bleeding, usually knowing where the location of the bleed is that we can, unlike the lower GI tract, the upper GI tract has a dual blood supply. So we can more often than not do some form of prophylactic embolization. So we don't need an active bleed, quote unquote, to go in and do angio with some sort of intervention. So I think the ability to have GI localize the bleed for us, and then the ability to embolize prophylactically without any evidence of active bleeding, I think allows us to sort of be confident that we don't need imaging pre-op.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's a great point. Being able to prophylactically embolize that GDA, or, I mean, do you ever even prophylactically embolize the left gastric in some situations?
Totally. I feel like those come in waves, but yeah, I mean, way more common to do the GDA just with duodenal ulcers being probably way more common with peptic ulcer disease. But yeah, it's not infrequent that we'll prophylactically take out the left gastric as well.
Yeah. Any contraindications to taking them, basically? Especially if it's active bleeding or even if it's intermittent bleeding, is there sort of any lab workup, anything else that you're asking questions about to determine whether or not this is even a good candidate for an embolization?
Yeah. I mean, I think with respect to contraindications, I think just general contraindications to angiography apply, such as renal function, coagulopathy, things like that. But the reality is if the patient is unstable enough, the benefits of embolization typically will outweigh those risks. But otherwise, minimal contraindications that I'm familiar with. I think one thing maybe to keep in mind, and it's incredibly rare, but we see a lot of trauma patients. We see a lot of patients who have had weird surgeries in the past, especially in the upper abdomen region. I think when you encounter patients who may have had surgical resections or some sort of altered anatomy, just keep in mind that dual blood supply may be compromised. And so you may want to have a little bit of a higher threshold potentially to do a prophylactic embolization for those patients.
That's a great point. Patients with Whipple or, you know, even they've suffered. I had a chronic pancreatitis patient who had so much scarring and such a really chronic inflammatory process. It had actually caused erosion into a branch of the splenic artery, and it actually was causing bleeding into the pancreatic duct. That was a source of the upper GI bleed. They couldn't figure it out. We were trying to embolize the GDA and then the left gastric and still bleeding. Come to find out there's this big aneurysm off the splenic. We just weren't looking in that direction. Isn't that wild?
So that's really crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you're right. I mean, just look at your CT. Even if there's maybe not enough time to order one, look at what they've had. Look at that anatomy, like you said, because the anatomy could totally change your approach, right?
100%. Yeah. I mean, I think you've highlighted how these cases can be not straightforward. Infrequently, it is just a GDA embolization or left gastric, but there is a lot of real estate in that area that you have to sort of interrogate sometimes.
Yeah. So we already kind of talked about pre-procedure imaging, but let's say it's a peptic ulcer and you're going to probably be going after the GDA. Just kind of walk us through your procedure.
Yeah, for sure. So I think pre-procedure, like we mentioned, hopefully the endoscopist has placed some clips or something that we can fluoroscopically identify. What we like to consider, I think, for most of us, quote unquote, bread and butter IR. So this is going to be your typical angiogram. For me, that means right femoral arterial access, 5 French sheath. Typically, we'll do a pigtail angiogram from the aorta and then followed by selective catheterization of the celiac artery and then selective catheterization of the GDA, doing angiograms from each of those points, identifying hopefully a focal bleed that you can then super selectively catheterize and then proceeding with embolization. For me, the closer you can get to an active bleed, that typically leans me towards using microcoils through a microcatheter. But if, as we sort of talked about earlier, if we are not doing selective embolization or for active bleeding, then I think a lot of other embolics potentially may come into play. Again, if we're referring to like a left gastric, for example, then I feel comfortable doing maybe even like a gel foam embolization of that vessel.
Yeah, I've always thought that was interesting. And can you explain why like left gastric, we're willing to do something temporary like gel foam, whereas GDA, we tend to just coil it? Can you, just for the trainees, like what's the difference is and why?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think with the GDA, as we know, it's an anastomotic connection with branches from the SMA via the pancreatic arcade. So, and then we have very distal branches that go out to the stomach. And so it just would probably take a ton more gel foam. It would be a little bit less controlled because you have these anastomotic communications. So we tend to just coil it because we have way more control. And we know that typically for our peptic ulcer, it's going to be bleeding that's coming off somewhere along the length of that GDA. Whereas in the left gastric, those are pretty much terminal branches along the lesser curvature of the stomach, and doing gel foam or some sort of liquid there probably is a little bit safer.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you for explaining that. And just a couple little technique things. Do you ever go radio access?
Yeah, for me personally, I don't, or don't do a lot of radial. That's just our institutional culture. You certainly can. I think obviously there's a lot of radial first institutions. And the reality is probably for a lot of these cases, the angles might be more favorable coming from that approach. But for me personally, I don't do a lot of radial.
Yeah, me either. Some people are like, oh yeah, we do even for like traumas. I'm like, really? Okay. But they have to be set up for it. It's like, it's got to be part of your routine, part of your tech's routine, part of the workflow. So it can't be inefficient in these kinds of situations, right?
Exactly. I think where radialists will advocate for the limited adoption with radial access actually is for those reasons. Like you said, staff is unfamiliar with it. The operator is unfamiliar with sort of the setup and, you know, the way you're looking at the screen and all that sort of stuff. And obviously in an emergency situation, those aren't things that you want to be worried about.
Right. And then for the trainees, again, once you select the celiac trunk, I forget, did you say you use a Cobra usually? I mean, what's your go-to catheter for that?
Yeah, I didn't go into catheter selection, so that's a great question. For me, typically, especially if the left gastric may come into play, I'll use a reverse curve catheter. And sort of one of the most, again, like you said, for the trainees, one of the most classic tricks or quote-unquote pearls to catheterize the left gastric is to take a reverse curve catheter like a VS1 or SOS catheter, which are probably the two most commonly used, to engage the orifice of the celiac artery and then attach it to a syringe of contrast, and then just gently pull it down. And essentially what happens is that tip of that reverse curve catheter drags along the roof of the celiac. And if you pull it down enough, it sort of just clicks into the left gastric. And if you're just gently puffing contrast as you do this, you'll see that it sort of just, as you're gently puffing, eventually you'll just pacify the left gastric, like kind of like it just popped out of nowhere. Now you're in there with your base catheter and you just need to feed your microcatheter in. So if I think I'm going to select the left gastric, I typically will do a VS1 or SLOS. If it is a GDA, then like you said, a Cobra 1 or an RC1 catheter typically is what I use.
Yeah. And then if you get it in the celiac trunk, like you pop in with your C2 or your Cobra, then are you doing like a celiac run first just to get a lay of the land? And if so, what's your injection rate? Or do you just hand inject?
Yeah, I'll do power injections. I think there's a lot of value in power injections, like you've sort of mentioned, because we're looking for a bleed. So you really want to give a good bolus of contrast at a high pressure to identify where this tiny little bleed may be coming from. Because more often than not, your body's trying to treat that bleed by spasming the vessel and trying to cut the flow off. So you may need to sort of force contrast down the throat of that vessel to identify it. So my typical injection rate from the celiac artery is 4 cc/s for a total volume of 16 cc's. So we typically say 4 for 16 is our rate. Is that what yours is?
Yeah, I think it was either 4 for 16 or 5 for 15, like depending on the size of the individual. Like if it's like a little petite old lady, then maybe it's like 3 for 12, something that's in that range though. Because you don't, like you said, especially if they're clamped down, otherwise you end up with a lot of reflux and like kind of a mixed picture. So you got to kind of try and get it right. But sometimes when you know exactly where the bleed is too, it's nice to just, if your Cobra just kind of pops down into that common hepatic, and then you can do a nice run from there too, especially if you know it's like off the GDA.
100%. I think the value of being able to do injections or runs through your base catheter, your 4 or 5 French catheter is invaluable. You get way nicer pictures, I think, if you're able to do it through there.
Yeah, and you never know what that celiac origin looks like, right? I mean, it could be all gunked up with, you know, atherosclerotic disease, especially in, like, again, in a little old lady. And sometimes just getting past that, so you don't also, the other thing for the trainees is if you're not well into that celiac trunk, you can bounce out with that injection pretty easily. And so that's where sometimes, especially with the CT checking it out, is being like, maybe I should get some more purchase and actually get into that common hepatic if there is narrowing in that celiac trunk. You know what I mean?
100%. I think I probably should have clarified why I use a C2 if we're going after the GDA or something more distal, because of that exact same reason. When you have a reverse curve catheter, you know, your catheter is kind of just barely hanging in the celiac. Whereas with a C2, like you mentioned, you can get a little bit more purchase, a little bit more stability. And that'll also help you downstream once you put the microcatheter in, because it makes it easier to select smaller vessels because you have more support with your base catheter.
Yeah, but it's challenging because sometimes it's the reverse curve that really helps you select the vessel because of the angle, but the CT helps you get distal. So it's kind of like what's in between. I've seen people use
like a SIM1 or SIM2.
Yeah, maybe a SIM1 or SIM2. That could work too. It's just tricky to get those further in, like you were saying.
I agree.
So yeah, I mean, it just depends on what you have on your shelf, right?
That's what it comes down to, is usually your hospital will choose for you what catheter you're going to use, because they're going to give you 3 or 4 options and you're going to just use one of those.
Exactly. So, all right, perfect. And then microcatheter, is there something that you really like? We won't hold you to it, but I mean, for us, it's always a ProGrate that's available, but there's a variety of different microcatheters out there. Some really have advantages, but ProGrate tends to be what works best in my practice.
Yeah, 100%. I think ProGrate for me is a workhorse microcatheter, really nice catheter from Terumo. Again, the reality is upper GI bleeding falls more into that bread and butter IR category. So you're probably going to be able to get this etiology or path of disease treated with pretty much any microcatheter that you have on your shelf. A lot of it just comes down to operator comfort and what you like to use. I think, like you mentioned, if you do get some weird bleed like that pancreatitis bleed where it might be coming off some tiny, tiny little branch or something crazy like that, then you may want to start thinking about your TrueSelect microcatheters, your ProGrate Alpha, those neuro microcatheters. We were just at Guess MSK where they're using 1.7 French microcatheters, that type of stuff where you might need to start doing fancy catheterizations.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then one more thing, and we're going to talk about your embolization devices, what's in your toolbox here in a minute, but I wanted to ask you one more thing about like the mesenteric anatomy and sort of, so we're talking about targeting the celiac, but in an upper GI bleed, do you also go and check from the SMA territory as well in terms of the back door after you've embolized?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially when we're dealing with bleeds that come off the GDA region, you always want to check the SMA for the reason you just alluded to, which is there may be collateral or reperfusion of that bleed from the back door, which is, again, along that pancreatico-duodenal arcade that arises between the GDA connects to celiac and SMA too. So we always check it on the way out. It is pretty rare to see that if you have done a selective catheterization, meaning you've gone into the actual artery that's bleeding and plugged it up. But if you only embolize a bleed from the front door and don't get across the, or if you're not able to select the bleeding vessel and you're not able to get distal to it, then you're at risk of backdoor perfusion of that bleed. So we always sort of routinely check it. And again, even if you have, I think, embolized the actual bleed from the direct artery, I think it was worth a quick injection from that SMA to make sure that you're not missing anything either.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And on the other GI bleed episodes we've talked about, the way I was taught, and you may have been taught this as well, it's like any GI bleed, you got to do a celiac run, SMA run, IMA run. And I think that was back before the time of like CTA, right? Where it was, every GI bleed was like a diagnostic angiogram. I think we're past that now, where we're getting more information. We know usually know exactly where the bleed is, and we can just do one, at most, maybe two vessels. It's rare, unless like the bleed is in that watershed area, that you got to do all three vessels. Definitely not all three. I mean, I don't know when that would be the case. What's your thoughts on that? I was just curious.
Yeah, I agree. It's funny. I think we've gone through the same, probably similar time, the training and evolution of treatment. 100%. When I was younger, earlier fellowship days, it was not uncommon to do a mesenteric angiogram, which meant selecting all three of those vessels and seeing if anything's bleeding. Now it's incredibly rare, again, because CTA has sort of become a dominant workhorse sort of imaging modality for the evaluations, particularly of lower GI bleeding and or sort of obscure bleeding, like you mentioned, in the abdomen, maybe post-surgical, things like that. So more often than not, we know exactly where that bleed is coming from, and we'll go ahead and target that vessel. And like you said, maybe select a second vessel to make sure there's no collateral reperfusion kind of thing.
But I mean, it's like less is more now. Like less radiation is definitely more. It's better for everybody, right? And less contrast is better for the patient. So that's my opinion. I know there's maybe some old school people out there still like, nah, you got to check everything. But I just don't, if you find the bleed and you embolize it, like you're done.
I agree 100%.
So we've talked about gel foam in the case of left gastric, and we've talked about coils. When you talk about coils, are you talking about detachable or non-detachable coils? I think I know the answer, but.
Yeah. Actually, I'd be curious to hear what you think, but my practice actually has changed a little bit or evolved. I actually was trained primarily on detachable coils, and early in my practice was 100% detachable coils. I've now come into a practice that's a little bit more cost conscious and has a lot more old school faculty that I am partners with. And so they've actually sort of turned me on to pushable coils in the correct scenario. So I'm using a lot more of what I would say combination pushable and detachable coils. I think there is some value to fibers. So where pushable coils, you know, obviously are fibered, and there's certain detachable coils that are also fibered. But yeah, I still say I'm primarily detachable with some pushable mixed in there.
I tell you what, man, I mean, I used almost nothing but pushable in fellowship and then early out of fellowship because nobody had, like even at Vanderbilt, like we tried them and then, you know, the little clicky thing wouldn't work and you'd have to bend the wire and like everybody's just like, enough of with this detachable stuff. And that, you know, that was 10 years ago, but now they're really slick and they work really well. And I just had a case last month where I used some like very specific coils that fit perfectly and they sat perfectly. And like, it's just so much better than just kind of like, even those little halals you'd squirt them in with saline. Have you ever done that before? With distal?
I mean, I think that's the appeal of the pushable coil, I think, is that you can kind of shoot them in and the trainees love that. But again, it's got to be in the right scenario, got to be in a really safe situation, that sort of thing.
But a big long coil, like a nester with, oh gosh, those make me nervous now. You know what I mean?
Totally. And like you said, the new coils on the market now, the lengths, the variety of sizes, the ability to essentially place them like they're wires, like they just come out so soft.
Yeah.
It's been revolutionary or game changing.
Yeah, exactly. That's most of the people that come on the show say they're using detachables, non-detachables in select scenarios for cost reasons, right? And they still serve a purpose. But there is new stuff on the market. And we did do a recent episode again with Dr. Kevin Hensler, where he was talking about, and we actually had Zeev Haskell on the show recently as well, talking about how people are using glue in GI bleeds. I don't know about upper GI bleeds, but Kevin was talking about Obsidio, which he's used for lower GI bleeds. And I know you have some experience using that as well. Can you tell us about that and like how you started using it?
Totally. Obsidio is obviously, as you mentioned, is a newer embolic. It's a non-Newtonian fluid, which is, I think, really interesting. And we can talk a little bit about the physics of it, but it's a conformable embolic or like a gel-like material that is very interesting. I've fortunately known about it for a long time, just following some of Dr. Oklu's work when he was in his lab sort of developing it. And again, I find it to be a very interesting embolic because it is sort of liquid-like or sort of has some liquid properties in terms of placing it, but is relatively, I think, simpler to use compared to most liquid embolics on the market. And again, like you mentioned, I've had fortunate opportunity to use it for quite a number of cases now, and mainly in sort of traumatic or bleeding situations. And I've really liked it because of its ability to, you really need only really tiny amounts of it, and you can really just essentially embolize bleeds very quickly. So I like it for its speed, ease of use, and its ability to get a durable occlusion in a very short amount of time.
Okay, yeah, that's kind of similar to what Kevin was saying. And he had been using it very rarely, I think mostly for GI bleeds. But how did you, when you first started using it, like how did you choose which cases or which patients to use it in, right? Because a lot of, like you said, like some of them were like emergent situations. When were you like, oh, this would be a good Obsidio case? Had you had some experience in the animal lab before where you kind of knew the nuance? I imagine there's like some nuance to using it, right?
Yeah, I actually was fortunate. I had used it in an animal lab prior, only once or twice. With that said, I think there are some fundamental pearls or tips that I could probably give, especially to trainees who may be using it. But I started with the IFU use for it. And I think that's, the IFU obviously always kind of keeps you out of trouble in general. But so it's meant to be delivered through a 5 French or high flow microcatheter. So like a 2.8 French prograde, for example. And I think where it's probably best served to be used, again, using the IFU, is to be used in vessels that are less than 3 millimeters in size and where you have like a long landing zone, you know, where you have maybe some forgiveness. There is a learning curve to using this. This is not a liquid in terms of the way a liquid behaves when you exert force on it. It does take a lot more force, injection force, to get it out of your microcatheter. So there is a little bit of sort of learning curve in terms of getting used to that or getting comfortable with that force that's required. And then also the radio opacity of it is less than most liquid embolics. So you have to get used to what its appearance is as well. So having it in a small vessel that has a long landing zone gives you a little bit of play to get used to it coming out of the microcatheter, seeing it and all that sort of stuff. It looks a little bit like dilute contrast actually when it first starts coming out. And then as you progressively give a little bit more, it darkens. So again, you have to get used to that. Another tip that I usually tell people, especially when they're starting out, really magnify. We were talking about radiation, things like that. This is especially in early on, this is a scenario where you don't want to not be able to see it. And again, you want to get comfortable with seeing it. So really magnify. If you have like a Philips system, for example, use high fluoro flavor or turn up the radiation essentially, and really make sure you can see it coming out again, because early on, getting used to its appearance is a little bit of an adjustment. And the reason the radio opacity is not super high is you'll see the benefit of it is downstream on follow-up imaging and things like that. It doesn't have that sort of streak artifact or beam artifact that you get with your typical liquid embolics, like Onyx, for example.
Like Onyx, yeah. Were you ever using Onyx or glue for GI bleeds before? Or is this your first sort of like, I guess, change from coils?
Yeah, this is definitely my first foray, I think, outside of coils for GI bleeds specifically. I had used liquids incredibly rarely or infrequently for GI bleeds, typically for super coagulopathic patients where I couldn't get very selective or distal. For me, that's where in my algorithm that I had applied liquids for. but this is a little bit different. I think you'll hear people say that actually Obsidio kind of behaves like a liquid coil the way it comes out. You'll see some videos of its benchtop. It literally does look like a coil the way it comes out of the microcatheter, but sort of like a gel or liquid form.
Gel, yeah. It's almost like a category all of it in its own. It's not coil, it's not liquid. It's like some sort of semi-solid category, right?
Yeah.
I wonder what they're going to put it in, right? Because everybody likes to put it in these different buckets. So I wonder where it's going to fall.
100%. Yeah, it looks like, to me, it looks like caulk or toothpaste. Like, to me, the consistency of it.
Interesting. Yeah, I can't wait to try and see how it works. So you mentioned doing an animal lab. Were there any other resources that you leveraged or were able to use to like get trained up on it? I imagine reps were helpful. Anything else that, like, are there any papers out there? Any resources for people that want to also get their hands on it?
Yeah, great question. I think talking to people obviously always helps, using whatever network that you have of people who have tried it and used it, and getting tips and pearls obviously is helpful. The company does a nice job of supporting those cases, like you mentioned, with rep support. And then I would probably make a plug for things like the guest Obsidio webinar that we did. It has a bunch of excellent lectures that are specific to this topic and sort of go over early experiences from a lot of folks.
Okay, perfect. And what was your first case? Was it a GI bleed or a trauma? I don't remember what you said.
Yeah, I think my first case actually was a pre-op tumor embolization.
Oh, okay.
Like those RCCs that you're often referred to devascularize prior to an orthopedic surgery. And then I had sort of a run of them, actually, like when I wanted to start using Obsidio, which was really nice. So I used it for that. I also had a trauma, like a liver laceration case that I used it for. So not exactly upper GI bleeding per se, and the upper GI tract, I guess.
Okay. Yeah. So those are great procedures, I guess it sounds like, to try it on in addition to GI bleeds. Any other procedures that you could see? I mean, for example, I think Ziv mentioned like a great case to start doing glue with was portal vein embo. I mean, it sounds like the pre-op tumor embolization, it's kind of the same thing, right? It's like, it's not urgent. It's not a trauma. It's not a GI bleed. It seems like that kind of setting would be the best place to start something like this.
I think so. I think a case like that would be excellent because there is some sort of definitive surgical management that's going to be occurring afterwards.
Right.
You can kind of pick and choose which vessels that you think are ideal to embolize. So you have some choices there. I think another good place probably is a GDA because it's such a long, straight vessel more often than not. In that scenario, I have not done it yet, but I've talked to some colleagues who have, who recommend maybe placing like a distal coil just to give it a little bit of a backstop and then lacing the entire GDA with the Obsidio. I think that would be another nice sort of first case because you have such a long runway to place the embolic.
Cool. I guess last thing I want to talk about, I mean, we talked about embolization materials, new embolization materials. I wanted to kind of find out a little bit about your post-procedure care when it comes to upper GI bleeds with a few minutes that we have left. Are you typically leaving it, like sometimes like bleeders will leave a sheath in if they're going out to the ICU just so that they can monitor and everything. Tell us a little bit about your post-procedure care once you've done embolizing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we typically will leave any sort of access behind unless it's specifically requested by the ICU. And that's typically if they want us to leave venous access, like a triple lumen for resuscitative measures. So I think, like you mentioned, probably preoperatively, it's important that these patients have good venous access because if they're unstable, they're going to need to get bolus infusions of saline. So that's typically what we're doing. Very rarely, if you get somebody who's very, very sick in terms of have lost a lot of blood, very clamped down, very coagulopathic, that's when we will leave our sheath in place, I think, because we feel that it might be dangerous to remove the sheath and or it may cause some problems if we do in terms of access site complications. And the last thing they can do is afford to lose more blood secondary to that complication.
Yeah.
So we will do things like that and then bring them the next day if they're stable to close the access. But that's relatively infrequently. More often than not, we're removing the access and then we're just following them clinically, serial hemoglobin monitoring. And then if they re-bleed, sort of coordinating with GI in terms of what the next interventional steps are.
Yeah, perfect. Well, Oz, that's all I have for the upper GI bleed. Anything I left out? Any final thoughts?
No, not too much. I think this is a really comprehensive overview. I think for probably a lot of practicing interventional radiologists, this is straightforward stuff. But for trainees, there's, as you can see, there is a little bit of nuance to a lot of these things. And I think it's great that we have a lot more embolics like Obsidio coming on the market to help us treat these things.
I mean, even for guys out in practice, there's some locations where upper GI bleeds are kind of few and far between, and you kind of have to remember what the anatomy is, what all should I target. You just to give you that what I did for that bleed that bled into the pancreatic duct, it was this like really goofy looking pseudoaneurysm with a wide neck, and I couldn't coil it. It was just the positioning of it and everything. And so I put a covered stent across it and the splenic, and then it was gone. It was pretty amazing. It was probably one of my all-time favorite cases.
Yeah. How big was the splenic artery?
It was sizable. It was like I put it like an 8-millimeter stent in there. Yeah.
Wow. That's enormous. Wow.
It was big.
Holy cow.
It was big. Yeah. From what I remember. I don't have to, yeah.
Yeah. I haven't done that many times, but I feel like 50% of the time I'm planning to place a covered stent in the splenic, I can't get the sheath or delivery system there. It's splenic artery is so tortuous and it can be very challenging.
Thankfully, it was like right before the pancreatic tail. So it was right before it takes that sort of curly cue. So it was like a straight path. But yeah, it was really challenging. It was a fun case. Okay, cool. Thanks, man.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us @_backtable on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Backtable is produced and hosted by myself, Aaron Fritz, and co-hosts
Chris Beck,
Sabine Dong,
Michael Barraza,
and Ali Behetti.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles,
Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz.
Social media and PR by Ann Dang,
Manisha Naganathanahalli,
and Manveer Singh Subli.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kinnebrew.
Intro and extra music is Ripperoo by Skeptic Moon. Find us on Spotify or at local live music venues in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Thanks again for listening.